From Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network, welcome to Cafe Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Joyce Vance.
How you doing, Joyce?
I'm doing good, Preet. Is it cold where you are?
Yeah, you know, that's an understatement. I mean, I know it's colder in some parts of the country, but as we speak and record right now, it's 18 degrees.
It's not quite that cold in Alabama, but you know, anytime it's below 60 here, milk and bread flies off the shelves, and we actually had snow over the weekend.
Yeah, we had a little more snow last night, but you know, we're fine. We're fine. Just stay away from I-95, right?
No kidding.
What are we going to talk about this week? Is there news?
There's so much going on, big legal stuff and little legal stuff. Where do you
little legal
start?
Stuff. We talk about the big stuff, Joyce.
We talk about the big stuff. It's all big. I mean, there are a lot of interesting things going on, civil cases happening and all sorts of stuff.
So should we talk about January 6th? Because it's becoming sort of interesting to try to discern what is going on. You and I both watched and read and observed closely, you know, an interesting speech given last week after we last recorded by the sitting Attorney General Merrick Garland on the eve of the January 6th first anniversary. I've written about it a little bit, heard some of your commentary, but for our insider listeners, what was your reaction?
I thought Merrick Garland said all the right things. I was comfortable that he committed that his investigation of January 6th would not be limited to the people who stormed the Capitol, those prosecutions we're seeing now. But he left two big questions unopened. The big one is, will he actually follow through, right? Trust but verify. And then, of course, the question that you've been raising is, okay, it's great he came and made this speech. Where has he been up until now?
Yeah, you know, I thought it was a good speech, if you're judging it based on rhetoric. And as I wrote last week in my note, for insiders, they really wanted to get across this one message, right? That one money passage where he said,
"The Justice Department remains committed to holding all January 6th perpetrators at any level accountable under law, whether they were present that day or were otherwise criminally responsible for the assault on our democracy. We will follow the facts wherever they lead."
Which was clearly intended to signify that it's not just the 725 people who trespassed or engaged in violence against cops, but the fight and effort to hold other people accountable extended upwards, right? And as I also pointed out, like that was more clear than ever when that was the only paragraph that was sent out to the press distribution list in advance of the address. They really wanted to get that message across, even though it was slightly indirect language. You know, Trump's name wasn't mentioned. He didn't say, you know, all higher up folks. So it was, you know, carefully crafted language intending to mollify people who were worried that no ringleaders would be investigated or otherwise held accountable. But the question that you and I have been discussing, and I don't have an answer to, is if that is true, and if they're doing an investigation to hold people at all levels accountable, how come we haven't heard or seen any sign of it? Because as we know, when people around the president are approached by either the 1-6 committee or issued a subpoena, whether it's by Tish James or anyone else, they balk, they squeal, and they get upset, and they say things in the press. And not one of those things has happened. What do you think about that?
I think that's something that has been really troubling, to see no signs of investigation. You know, Merrick Garland in the past has run some really close-hold investigations. He oversaw Oklahoma City. He was involved in the Unabomber case. Both of those went to indictment without a lot of prior media attention. But it was a different era. It was an era without the scrutiny that investigations are subjected to. They weren't cases that had held the national interest. I mean, they were important cases, don't get me wrong, but not in the same way that efforts to interfere with a presidential election are. I've felt all along like we should be seeing some signs of investigation. It's troubling that we aren't. But it's also in some ways just unthinkable, the word that you used in the piece that you wrote, unthinkable that there wouldn't be investigation at DOJ on this set of facts.
Yeah, I mean, as we were discussing before we hit record, it's possible that they've done other things like get communications from third parties, emails, text messages, and that sort of thing. But at some point after a year has gone by and after another body, the 1-6 Select Committee, has been interviewing or seeking the interviews of person after person after person who could reveal the state of mind of the then president and what his intentions were, it's kind of mind-boggling that more hasn't been done. And there's no evidence that they've even done those things. Would you expect to hear now, given the speech of DOJ/FBI approaches of some of these people in and around the White House?
So it's surprising that we wouldn't hear about those approaches at the get-go. Of course, we don't know what DOJ is or isn't doing. You know, maybe there are cooperation agreements and people aren't speaking, but that really sort of stretches the imagination. So without regard to what's happened for the last year, I think the hope has to be that Merrick Garland's world was rocked a little bit by all of the criticism and that he has a new appreciation of the need to investigate, and also to demonstrate, not in an inappropriate way, right? Because prosecutors should never reveal the details of ongoing investigations. But guidelines at DOJ, the Justice Manual, does permit the Attorney General to make comments on investigations of national significance that people know are in progress. I think he went right up to the extent of what he was authorized to do under those guidelines in the speech last week. And he would have the ability to continue to do that in a very low-key way that wouldn't prejudice the investigation down the road. But Preet, there's something else that really troubles me here, and it's something that you and I have talked about. If we were running a criminal investigation, I don't think we'd be sitting aside and letting Congress subpoena and talk to all of our witnesses, because that creates alternative statements that then can constrain your investigation. There's some risk that if people get compelled, that you impair your ability to prosecute them at all. I mean, there's a lot of crossover here. And the fact that the January 6th committee is going ahead so forcefully, so directly, working on Christmas Day, the chairman says, while DOJ is taking a back seat, that really gives me some concern as well.
Yeah, look, it happens from time to time that DOJ investigates some conduct and Congress feels the need to investigate that same conduct. And sometimes, if DOJ is lucky, it can forestall the congressional investigation for all the reasons you describe. But sometimes Congress will not, you know, step aside and you do things in parallel, and it's not ideal. But at a minimum, you know, DOJ looks at something and Congress looks at something and you try to coordinate somewhat, you know, there's some line of communication open, so that the congressional investigation, which is never going to hold anyone criminally accountable, it's never going to charge anyone, right? Just do a report or make findings, but do it in a way that's not going to unduly prejudice the criminal investigation. But we see no sign of that here. And, you know, somebody suggested that maybe it's innocuous and for political or other reasons, I don't know what legal reason there would be, but for political and optics reasons, Merrick Garland was deferring to the 1-6 committee, and depending on what they find, then they would go full bore into an investigation. Does that make any sense to you?
It doesn't. There is one piece of that could be helpful. The notion of getting a referral from a bipartisan congressional committee might give Merrick Garland some cover for investigating. Maybe it's the work going on at the January 6th committee that has pushed him a little bit to this point. But he doesn't need that cover. He is, in fact, the Justice Department. It is his obligation to investigate serious crimes. And where I always return to on this is, what's more serious than the effort to interfere with an election? What's more serious than the effort to undo the will of the voters? You know, it's the Department of Justice. Justice is in the name of the agency. If it's here for anything, it's here to investigate what happened in the 2020 election.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. So, you know, we're speculating, but as I often say, speculating, you know, with some basis of experience, track record, and knowledge. And I don't know what the explanation is. I'm sorry to say.
Well, giddy up, DOJ.
Should we talk about other things that the committee is doing?
You know, we should, because they really have been working.
I think they're doing a
really
great job.
Quickly, yeah.
So one thing you said a moment ago, which is, I find, an interesting distinction to make. DOJ has a tradition, culture, and actual, you know, regulations and norms about not revealing progress of an investigation. You hear about things because sometimes witnesses talk and defense lawyers get information and they talk and they go to the press. But DOJ officials, you know, I wasn't updating anyone on investigations on an ongoing basis. You know, some exceptions are when a bomb goes off at the Boston Marathon and lives are at stake and there's a terrorist threat, there are updates, you know, things like that happen. But generally speaking, you don't do that. Very different from the dynamic in a congressional investigation where, and it's not inappropriate, and there are no norms that govern this in the opposite direction. They are selectively and at will releasing information about their investigation. Last week, they put out information about texts that they had received that were sent by or received by Sean Hannity on and around January 6th. And they do that in connection with a letter they sent to him asking for his voluntary testimony. But they set forth a whole bunch of things that the Fox News broadcaster, Sean Hannity, had said and providing reasons why they want his testimony, among others, to understand the frame of mind and the state of mind of the sitting president at the time. You think there's anything weird or inappropriate in the context of a congressional committee throwing off to the public developments in their investigation along the way?
You know, as a member of the public, I'm unbelievably grateful that they're telling us what they're learning. Thinking about it in a professional sense, there's been a lot of communication from this committee to the public. I mean, look, you interviewed Adam Schiff, was it a month ago? It was before Christmas, right? And Schiff was, I think, pretty forthcoming about what the committee was doing and what some of the frustrations with DOJ were at that time. It's really snowballed since then. I think what you're asking maybe is, should Liz Cheney have said that the committee was considering criminal referrals to DOJ? I thought that was a pretty startling and alarming sort of thing for her to say. Alarming not in a bad sense, alarming because it seemed to indicate a lot of frustration within the committee about the pace of what was going on at DOJ. So I'm equivocating a little bit and not answering your question. If I was sitting at DOJ, I wouldn't want the committee to be this forthcoming if I was investigating. And maybe that's an answer in some part to the question that we kicked off with.
Yeah, so my view is congressional investigations are different. They require momentum. They require the support of the public. The fact that they're doing things that they're doing and showing a public need for certain testimony, because this is how the world works, has an impact and consequence on the mind of the person who is contemplating coming in. So, for example, Sean Hannity, if everything was behind the scenes and they sent a secret letter, you know, Sean Hannity and his lawyers could say, I'm a journalist, you know, can't come in, First Amendment, and there'd be no pressure really to come in. What they're doing is making a public point about a couple of things. One, you know, the direct relevance of the Sean Hannity texts and email messages, if there were any. And second, that they're not asking him about his journalistic professional behavior. Himself has said, essentially, in various contexts, he's not a journalist. He's more of an entertainer. And the committee has made clear they're not asking him about his broadcast. They're not asking him about his reporting in any sense. But what he did, essentially, as a private citizen, in advising and communicating with the President of the United States and Mark Meadows and others. I mean, we should probably mention some of the things, in case people missed it, that Sean Hannity said around January 6th, because it's kind of stunning.
Before you do that, can I push back just a little bit on what you're saying? I think if you're sitting in the congressional hot seat running this investigation, the points that you're making are all well taken, the need for momentum and so on. But the chairman of the committee, Benny Thompson, made a point of saying that the committee wasn't going to do this sort of daily take on what was going on with the investigation. They didn't want it to become last week's news cycle, and that they would wait, that they would hold hearings in the new year, now the current year, and
yeah,
that they would tell
that.
The story
they are,
all at
drip,
once.
But they're
and
not
so
doing
why
that.
Do you think, so why do you think that he, you know, came out and said very clearly, this is going to be the strategy, and then it didn't happen? Was that disagreement on the committee? Did Liz Cheney decide to go it her own? Or do you think that they decided that your view was correct?
I don't know. I think they're doing a little bit of both. They have a lot of information that is unrevealed, right? They have a lot of dots that they're connecting. But every once in a while, they're putting out something tantalizing I think, to show a few things. One, that they're serious. Two, that they want public pressure on people who haven't yet come in to come in. And, you know, they want to keep people interested and believe that they're doing doing the work that they're supposed to be doing. And they're not necessarily inconsistent with each other, right? He's not revealing to the public everything, but, you know, selectively on occasion, here's a little bit of information. And they're not doing it explicitly to tantalize the public. It was in the context of sending a letter requesting voluntary testimony from Sean Hannity. And in the context of doing that, they set forth a lot of information, which is nice for the public to be able to consume.
You said something so interesting there. You said that they're doing enough so the public can have confidence that they, Congress, are doing what they're supposed to be doing. Again, something that we should be seeing from DOJ, right? Nothing improper, just enough to let us know they're on it. It's real interesting that Congress is sensitive to that, that the committee is doing that, at least speaking through these publicized requests for people to come in and testify, and that we're not seeing that from DOJ.
Part of the problem is, at the end of the day, the committee is not irrationally raising expectations. Everyone knows that the committee is not arresting Donald Trump or charging Donald Trump. They're going to have, you know, a set of public hearings, and then they'll have a comprehensive report laying out what happened. That's all. That's the end game for them, right? It's hard for anyone to be disappointed in what the committee does, because that's all it can do at the end of the day. On the other hand, and part of what may be animating the lack of action or the lack of rhetoric about action in the Department of Justice is they don't issue a report at the end of the day. They either make a criminal charge or not. And to the extent, and I think this is going on in Merrick Garland's mind and other people's minds, the more you raise expectations that you're doing a lot of stuff, the more you raise expectations that you're going to charge the former president. And they don't want to raise that expectation because maybe for legal and other reasons, they don't think that that's a great likelihood, right? That's a balance between doing a thorough investigation, which we don't have evidence of, and getting people in the public to think that at the end of the day, they're going to have a case to make.
That seems to me to be all the more reason for DOJ to be talking to the public. And this is what I mean when I say there's stuff that they can talk about and stuff they can't talk about. Specifics of a grand jury investigation, DOJ can't talk about that. Talking about process and how they run investigations, not necessarily in the context of this case, that's a legitimate scope sort of thing. And Garland did some of that in his speech. He did sort of a prosecution 101 basics thing, talking about how they worked. I'd like to see more of that from him. I think if we're talking about setting public expectations in a way that's realistic, DOJ doesn't do that by refusing to talk about this, because there's going to be speculation nonetheless, and there's all sorts of crazy conspiracy theories, you know, everything from Trump is king and JFK is coming back to life to DOJ is sitting on a bunch of sealed indictments and they're going to charge Trump tomorrow. Something Garland could do is lead a public education conversation about how DOJ does its work and why it does it that way. That's what's missing. People often don't understand, why does DOJ operate in secret? What does DOJ do? He could do more of what he did in his speech in that regard.
Yeah, although I don't think that's his nature.
It doesn't seem to be.
Number one. And number two, I don't think they're doing anything. So I don't know how you explain that. Now, going back to Sean Hannity for a moment, you know, I'm looking at the letter the Select Committee sent. And it's super interesting, right? They're trying to forestall objections over the First Amendment. They say, quote, "We do not intend to seek information from you regarding your broadcasts on radio or television, your public reporting or commentary, or your political views regarding any candidate for office. Thus, we write today to seek your voluntary cooperation on a specific and narrow range of factual questions," end quote, which I think is smart, makes them sound reasonable, and makes it more likely that a court will agree with the committee that they can get some of this testimony. Now, the interesting thing is they set forth a bunch of the texts, including this one on December 31 from Sean Hannity to Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff, quote, "We can't lose the entire White House counsel's office. I do not see January 6th happening the way he is being told." And he says some other stuff. Isn't that fascinating?
It's utterly fascinating, because normally you would expect a broadcaster, a news guy, even a quasi-entertainment guy would have a First Amendment privilege to maintain, and there'd be no chance that there would be an enforceable subpoena. But what these texts do is they show that Sean Hannity had two different jobs, right? I mean, apparently by night he was doing a TV show, and by day he was an advisor to the President of the United States and those around him. And I think that may well let him slip outside of First Amendment territory.
I mean, what do you think would happen if Jake Tapper was found to have been sending text after text after text advising Joe Biden or Barack Obama about policy and about campaigns? Don't you think the folks on the other side would squawk to the heavens?
Absolutely. And the fact that there's been no suggestion that Hannity played an improper role, I think actually comes back to bite him. You know, there are those 2016 comments where he's accused of going much easier on Trump in interviews than he went on Hillary Clinton. And his response is, I'm not a news guy. You know, I'm essentially an entertainment guy. I think if this gets to the point where there's a subpoena, I think that there's a big if there. But if it gets to that point and they're in court, I think all of those comments really come back to hurt Hannity and could lead to an enforcement of a subpoena against him, even though he is a, quote, journalist.
Here's another fascinating text, and it's part of the portrait that's being painted of Donald Trump not doing anything, even after being encouraged to do so by person after person after person. Reports that Ivanka Trump asked him and various other people, and one of those people, it turns out, per this text, was Sean Hannity, who texted Mark Meadows, on January 6th, saying President Trump should, quote, ask people to peacefully leave the Capitol, end quote. The committee also is interested in finding out what kind of conversations were had about some effort to remove the president under the 25th Amendment. So they must be onto something there, right?
They have to be. It's awfully specific. And it all goes back, you know, same key question, whether you're the committee or DOJ. Is Trump's state of mind? What did he know? What did he believe? Did he really think he'd won the election and he was pursuing fraud? That seems extraordinarily unlikely. But still, you've got to prove the opposite. You've got to prove that he knew he had lost the election. And it wasn't that he was trying to prevent fraud. It was that he was trying to engage in a fraud of his own. These comments in connection with the request that Hannity testify make it very clear that the committee thinks he has valuable knowledge in regard to that. And if he was talking directly to Trump and could repeat conversations that there is no possible privilege for outside of the First Amendment, right? There's no specter of executive privilege here. This testimony could be bombshell. And what's the impact for Hannity if ultimately he's subpoenaed and compelled to testify and he refuses to be truthful? He ultimately has to be truthful if the committee is able to push this that far.
Well, I think there's a question that comes before whether or not he's going to be truthful.
Yeah.
Is he going to come in? And you've jumped precisely.
Well, without
precise
a subpoena,
where,
right?
So I think the committee has generally been asking people for testimony on a voluntary basis, and when they refuse, they issue a subpoena. And now, so here's what's interesting, right? They're laying the groundwork for why a subpoena is appropriate, even though nominally Sean Hannity is a member of the press. What's going to happen when he says, go to hell, gives them the Heisman? Are they going to make a referral of Sean Hannity? It's a little bit trickier because of public perception. And, you know, he is, again, nominally a journalist. Members of Congress care about the First Amendment. You don't want to open the door to all sorts of press folks being called in, although he's not being asked about his broadcast responsibilities. They make the referral to DOJ, I think, if there's a full rejection of the subpoena. What does DOJ do with Sean Hannity? It's a bit of a hot potato, right?
It really is. And there's another twist on it too, right? Which is that Hannity's lawyers, Fox's lawyers, could easily move to quash, not squash, the subpoena.
It's not
on
squash.
The basis of the nor is it squish. So they could move to squash on the basis of the First Amendment.
You said squash.
Win
now.
Or lose.
You said squash.
No, I said quash.
Okay.
Quash. Quash. It would take time. It would be the delay game with the midterms looming. So that could be the Hannity strategy here. Try to avoid testifying for so long that it's no longer a problem for you. But your pure legal question, what does DOJ do? I think DOJ looks at the law and the facts. And the facts here are that Hannity himself has said he is not a journalist. He has acted here as an advisor to the president, i.e. a fact witness, not someone who should be cloaked in the First Amendment for that sort of conduct. And they enforce the subpoena. And just to make that point, right, the fact that you're a New York Times journalist covering a presidential beat doesn't mean that you have a First Amendment right to avoid testifying if you see a car crash outside of the White House. Hannity is a witness to the car crash.
So I agree with you that the Sean Hannity issue is fraught, but we should remind folks that even though Steve Bannon was indicted by the Department of Justice on the basis of contempt of Congress— they have another case and referral pending on which they have not acted. And it's been a lot of weeks, much longer than the amount of time they took to consider the Bannon referral, and that's Mark Meadows. What do you think's happening there?
DOJ, at the very deliberate pace that Merrick Garland referenced in his speech, right? I mean, we will serve no wine before its time was sort of what we heard in that speech. They are taking a lot of time with Meadows. There's obviously the executive privilege issue there. Could they have made a decision to not prosecute and they just haven't revealed that? They typically send a letter back to Congress, although maybe not in the most timely of fashions. But the longer the clock ticks, the less convinced I am that they're going to prosecute, although I think they should. I think it's warranted based on the law and the facts here.
Let's talk about a couple of other witnesses before we move on. Jim Jordan? What do you think is going to happen there?
This is this novel question of whether or not Congress can force one of its members to testify. So a couple of decision points here. First off, the committee is going to have to decide what they're going to do if Jordan won't testify voluntarily. And spoiler alert, Jordan won't testify voluntarily. So do they subpoena him? It's a meaningless gesture if there's not someone out there to enforce the subpoena because Jordan's not going to testify pursuant to a congressional subpoena. They will have to be confident that DOJ will enforce that subpoena, and I just don't know that they are.
I think no matter what, they issue the subpoena, whether they're confident about DOJ or not, because they have their own goals and their own mission, and it's on DOJ if DOJ doesn't pursue it. And so no matter what, I think they issue the subpoena. We should also distinguish between two things, right? One is whether or not some of these witnesses will acknowledge and honor a subpoena and come in to testify at a deposition. The other is whether or not at some future date, when there are, you know, live primetime hearings with TV cameras, whether one or more of those witnesses will show up for that. And those are two very different enterprises, right? And you can imagine a person, even like Mark Meadows or Jim Jordan or someone else, who would feel one way about providing, and staffers too, who would feel one way about providing truthful information to, you know, counsel, professional staff behind closed doors, and feel a different way about coming before Congress in prime time and taking questions from the chairman of the committee or other members of the committee who were going to make a lot of hay about the things that happened. Do you draw a distinction between those two things and think that there might be some people who'd be prepared to do one but not be a guinea pig in the second?
I think that's entirely possible, but I'm going to throw it back at you because you've been there, at least in the Senate. What do you do to deal with that situation? Is it important to get that written statement or at least the written testimony, and then you progressively work with the witness to get them to the point where they will appear publicly, or is that too idealistic for this situation?
The real investigation occurs behind closed doors, right? So, you know, usually it's professional staff. When I, you know, did the one big investigation that I did, you know, I deposed the then Attorney General's chief of staff for like 8 hours on a Sunday. And there's a court reporter and you take it all down and you have a lot of time and there's no rush and you can do it on weekends and in evenings. And you collect all the information, you do your investigation, and then you have a public hearing at which it's unusual for there to be new revelatory information. The public hearing is to make clear to the American people what you found. It's like, it's basically like an oral report. And so you take some of the witnesses, not all of them, because some of them didn't have great information or you know, shocking information. And it's basically a public rendering of the highlights in front of cameras that you discovered and learned about behind the scenes? Like, nobody's going to watch a hearing, and members of Congress are not going to stick around for, you know, 9 or 10 hours per witness. Because as an initial matter, you don't know what the witnesses are going to say, whether they advance the ball or not, whether they're evasive or not. So you do all of that. And then for the public, you bring back the people who were most compelling.
So does it ultimately work? We live in a society where a lot of the country gets its news from news sources that are even less newsworthy than Sean Hannity, right? Does holding public hearings with this tightly detailed narrative that you're talking about, does that work to give the country a common shared set of facts to operate under?
I was going to agree with the first part and say yes, but then there's a twist at the end. Common shared set of facts.
Yeah.
I think the days of that.
Something that's been lacking, right?
I think the days of that are over in this country. What I think it does give you, or can give you, is a common shared set of memories and moments. I was saying to someone recently, you know, I didn't read every page of the 9/11 report. I read a lot of it, maybe most of it. But what I remember and seared into my mind are particular moments from the 9/11 committee's commission's public hearings, like Condoleezza Rice testifying about that presidential daily brief. And those kinds of things are very important, right? So imagine a Sean Hannity or Ivanka Trump or Mark Meadows testifying about, or some of the things that Liz Cheney has hinted at, describing, you know, people who are allies of the president, describing on national television in prime time that Donald Trump was gleefully and happily watching television and coverage of the insurrection as it was happening, with ending it being the furthest thing from his mind. So we read that, you see it in the Times, you hear Rachel Maddow talk about it. That's one thing. It's very different from somebody within the presidential circle saying that under oath, solemnly, in front of a committee of Congress, don't you think?
I do, and my follow-up question for you is, would that be enough? Let's assume the worst. DOJ is doing nothing. DOJ isn't going to do anything. Does the committee coming forward and telling these powerful stories with images, let's assume for a minute that they can get an Ivanka or a Hannity to testify in these public hearings, is that enough for the country?
No. I mean, if someone can be held criminally accountable, then they should be. So I would say that that's not enough, but we don't know and may not know if someone should be held criminally accountable if there's no investigation. So, you know, I'm not sure what consequence, you know, even a riveting hearing would do in showing openly and transparently the blameworthiness of the former president. I mean, maybe it has the effect on some other Republicans. Maybe it has an effect on who runs for president, on whether Trump runs for president. You know, in some ways, you know, it may have the opposite effect on Trump. You know, when he gets embarrassed or people try to, you know, throw stuff up at him, sometimes his response is to try to vindicate himself.
The popular wisdom is that Democrats lose the Congress in the midterm elections. I think that you've agreed to that. Bill Kristol has said on Twitter that he's writing a piece tomorrow, former Republican, writing a piece suggesting that the Democrats may not lose the midterm elections. But let's just assume the common wisdom prevails and they do. That means the committee's work comes to an end. But DOJ is not constrained by the midterms, except that DOJ has a policy of not engaging in prosecutions too close to an election. Right? I mean, that's a long-standing policy that you can't interfere with elections. How does that all play out? Is the clock ticking at DOJ too, even though that may not technically be the case?
Yeah, I mean, the clock is ticking in the sense that if they're going to take some action in this, they're not going to do it in October, right? Probably not even in September. So either it happens before then, or there's a, and unlike the committee, you know, the DOJ remains, you know, operative and under Democratic president's control, they may have a pause. And so if you don't see anything by September, then maybe you won't see anything until December or January or February. I just don't know. It's hard to understand. Here's another thing, by the way. We've talked about Sean Hannity and Jim Jordan and various other people. You know, at some point, it's my belief that the committee will try to seek testimony. They won't get it, but will try to seek testimony from Trump himself, right?
Absolutely. They have to.
And a couple of points on that. One, some of these other people have a claim of executive privilege, some stronger than others, some weaker than others. But the weird thing about Trump, he has a weaker claim to executive privilege, if you think about it. Because what you're seeking from people like Mark Meadows is communications between him and the president, sitting president at the time. That's a communication about which you can argue there's a executive privilege or a deliberative process privilege. When you're talking to Trump and getting him to testify, you're not seeking his communications, because that doesn't matter. It matters somewhat. But you're mostly seeking to ask him about his own conduct and his own state of mind. There's no privilege there, right? If you say, you know, Mr. Trump, how long before you did anything? Mr. Trump, why didn't you do anything? Mr. Trump, were you watching television and seeing that Capitol Police officers were being harmed? What were you thinking at the time? There's no privilege that attaches to that. So in some ways, counterintuitively, the actual former president of the United States has less of a claim to privilege than his staff.
I think you're absolutely right about that. And there's a killer argument that Joe Biden made in his January 6th commemoration speech that might come into play here, too, because if the committee wants to ask Trump about his beliefs about the outcome of the 2020 election and whether he really believed that there was fraud, the point that Joe Biden makes is that Trump has never explained how it's possible that there was fraud that led to his failure to win, but all of the other elections that were on the same ballot, right, the senators and the congressional
races,
they
were all kosher.
How they were all kosher. And I think it would be, although like you, I think that they never do get Trump's testimony, it would be fabulous to point blank him with that unanswerable question.
So the next step here, which I don't know how this will play out, right? And it's even more fraught than Sean Hannity. The committee asks for Trump's testimony at some point in the future. Trump says, go to hell. The committee then has to contemplate making a referral to the Department of Justice. And so bear with me, because this is, I think, is really interesting. Now the Department of Justice has a completely intransigent witness who has centrally important information that is not privileged relating to the investigation of the committee, you know, reasonably sought, urgently and reasonably sought. And they have to make a decision about indicting the president, if there's a referral, on contempt of Congress. And so it is possible, and I wonder how you think this will play out, it is possible that the first and perhaps only charge that will ever be brought against Donald Trump, former president of the United States, will be a misdemeanor contempt of Congress. What do you think?
Is that really Merrick Garland's endgame? I mean, there are people speculating that Trump could be charged with misprision, which is a species of obstruction of justice. It's one of the most, in my judgment, really one of the most minor sort of charges in the federal criminal code.
You know, there was a listener question. A couple of people asked the question about misprision, and people read the statute, and it basically looks like, you know, it's sort of like an aiding and abetting a felony, and people read the statute and you think, well, you know, this would be used all the time. It is used almost never because it's a little bit of a silly statute, and it's considered, I mean, at least in our office, it was kind of considered a joke charge to bring. And the only time I ever used a misprision of felony was in a case where there was a significant narcotics distributor who became a fugitive. And years later, there was some question about whether or not the indictment could be dismissed based on failure to prosecute and investigate because he had been living in the community and the Marshal Service hadn't done a great job of trying to find the fugitive. And there's a motion you can bring after a certain amount of time that suggests there was not enough of an effort to advance the charge. And it was an open question whether it would survive or not. And so as a part of a plea agreement, so he would have a shorter term in prison, we agreed to a misprision of felony. Have you ever charged that?
You know, I don't think I ever actually charged it in a case, but there's a classic 11th Circuit case, the circuit that I'm in, called Brantley, where the defendant, who is the girlfriend of a man who just sort of spontaneously at a traffic stop shoots and kills a police officer. And he runs and he tells her to hide the car. And she takes the car to a friend's apartment and backs it in so that the license plate is concealed to make it harder for the police to find him. And she clearly doesn't know that he's going to shoot the officer. She's not culpable in the shooting, but they want to prosecute her for something. And so she's charged with misprision, which requires this element of concealing a crime, taking a step to conceal a crime. She's charged, she's convicted. But the panel judge who writes the concurrence, who's a former U.S. attorney in Atlanta, Beverly Martin, she's very explicit about the fact that this is a statute that should be used sparingly and in extreme circumstances. And she sort of says, this is the furthest I would go on a misprison case. I don't think we ever see that for Trump. By the same token, a misdemeanor, you know, failure to testify pursuant to a subpoena charge seems like pretty, sort of seems like bubkis compared to everything that
bubkis?
Trump has done.
I think it's bubkis.
Bubkis.
I think it's bubkis. Once again, we have a pronunciation controversy. People, please write into letters@cafe.com to explain whether it's bubkis or bubkis.
I really am going to have to do that Yiddish class on Duolingo. Punk up my pronunciation.
Yeah, but like, look, DOJ can't be considering, you know, what the ultimate possible accountability for Donald Trump is. They get presented with a referral for contempt. They have to consider it on its merits. Doesn't mean it's the end of the story for Trump, but it will be a weird thing. It'll be a weird thing. And I don't know how Garland and the Justice Department deal. I mean, I think they would rather never have to deal with that.
No right? Kidding.
Charging Trump with a misdemeanor for contempt of Congress. But look, if there's a track record of having charged Bannon, and if they choose to charge Meadows and maybe some others, what's the reason they give for not charging the president? It just looks lame, you're saying, right?
It does, but Bannon alone is not a track record, right? Bannon is a one-off case. We're waiting on Meadows. We're waiting to see what happens, you know, with former DOJ official. If they continue to charge, then Trump's position looks less stable.
So, you know, while we're on the subject of future possibilities, there's one that I know people don't like. I mentioned it once at a cocktail hour at a conference I was at in the fall, and people looked at me like I had four heads. But this idea that if Bill Kristol is wrong and the Democrats do lose the House, who becomes the Speaker of the House? And a lot of people just assume it's going to be Kevin McCarthy. I'm not saying the scenario I sketch out is likely or probable, but it's above zero. In the same way that Donald Trump back in 2015 had a slightly above zero chance of becoming the president of the United States, and people dismiss it out of hand, but there's no legal impediment, and there's quite a bit of political support for Donald Trump becoming the Speaker of the House in January of 2023. Now, some people are listening to this, and they know I've said this before. And other people have not heard me say this before, and their heads are exploding. And people say to themselves, well, that's silly. That requires real work. Really? Like the presidency required real work? And Matt Gaetz, who himself is under investigation, has suggested pretty strongly, and it's been received well by the other crazy people who are in the same category as Matt Gaetz, that Donald Trump would be a great Speaker of the House. What do you think of that?
You know, if you're Matt Gaetz, probably, because it's the next step to getting him back in the White House and getting you a pardon when you're convicted. But leaving that aside and just talking about the technical possibilities of Trump becoming the Speaker of the House, as a legal proposition, it is clear that he could become the Speaker. There's no requirement that you be a member of Congress. Nobody else on the staff in that office line is a member of Congress. It is a longstanding practice. The Speaker has always been an elected member. There's no reason that Matt Gaetz and buddies couldn't follow through and make it Trump.
Yeah, and you know, I say this not to freak people out, not to engage in, you know, absurd political speculation, but for people to really understand what's at stake in the 2022 midterms and what a circus-like atmosphere we could enter. And you could make the argument, you know, I could put on my Trump advocacy hat and say, Mr. President, what could be better and more fun than being Speaker of the House? First of all, it's an unprecedented thing. You'll go down in the history books as being the first non-member of the House of Representatives to be Speaker of the House. You're, what, a second in line to the presidency. You get to be the presiding officer. You get to preside over your vengeance against Joe Biden, who stole the election from you, and move forward with great speed and alacrity on impeaching Joe Biden. And you'll be in the news every day. Trump will have what he didn't have before, or what he's lacked a little bit of, being the center of the political universe, having all the attention of the national and world media upon him, Maybe even he gets his social media accounts back because he'll be, you know, irrelevant government official at that point. And it's a platform from which he can cause havoc. He can rally his folks. He's an actual political actor and can run for president again from that platform. It doesn't, you know, I know people think that it's crazy. It doesn't seem that crazy to me.
It doesn't feel crazy at all. It sounds like Trump's dreams come true, right? And it actually changes that first line of his obituary. Instead of a twice impeached president, he's a twice impeached president who became the Speaker of the House. I think that there's a lot here for Trump to like. And you put it in the context of the midterm elections. This is something that people should have at the forefront of their consciousness when they think about what's going to go on there.
Yeah. You know, Chris Hayes, who I think is a pretty smart guy, has suggested on social media that people should pay more attention to this possibility. We got into trouble a little bit in 2016 by people just scoffing at something that is of low likelihood. Things that are of low likelihood still happen. They just are of low likelihood, right? None of these things are zero. And the likelihood today of Trump being the Speaker of the House, to me, is much higher than the perceived likelihood in 2015 of him becoming president.
I think that that's right. And the problem that lies just underneath the surface here is, who's going to keep it from happening? Let's say the Republicans win at the midterms, they make Trump the speaker, and the Democrats say, oh, no, you can't do that. The speaker has to be a member. That's our long-standing practice. Are they going to get it into a court? Is a judge going to interfere in a dispute that's going on between the parties in Congress?
No, absolutely not. But I guess the intermediate question is, Trump has to want it. Let's say Trump wants it, and Matt Gaetz and his allies, I don't know how it works exactly, but put Trump's name forward. Question one is, does Kevin McCarthy step back, or does he compete against Trump? I'm not sure. Maybe he competes. Who wins in the House of Representatives, Trump versus McCarthy?
That's a crazy question. That's just crazy talk, right?
Yeah. But I think Trump wins.
I think he absolutely wins. I think people are so afraid of him. And this is the most inexplicable feature of the Trump presidency to me. But increasingly, I understand that whether it makes sense to me or not, it's the reality that we live with. A majority of the Republican Party and predominantly those who are elected to the Congress are so desperate to hang on to those jobs that they have to run for re-election for every 2 years that they will do whatever it takes to stay in Trump's good graces so he does not, you know, support a primary opponent who runs against them and beats them. It is an inexplicable failure of moral courage in this country.
There's another thing going on, too, and I think it's the descent into crazy land, circus atmosphere that Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert and that Trump encourages, right? Just complete political drama and craziness, which is not a political principle. It's not a governing principle. It's sort of an aesthetic, right? It's like, screw the libs, own the libs, trigger the libs. What could be better for that purpose, for that, you know, sort of general circus-like aesthetic than Donald Trump riding back into the Capitol as Speaker of the House?
It is the three-ring circus version of the Republican Party with Trump as the ringmaster. I mean, it's really how he's always operated as a politician.
Yeah, and he doesn't have to win a difficult nationwide election. You know, the more I think about it, I just don't understand. I think it'd be horrible for the country. I think it'd be horrible for the House and horrible for the Congress. But if I try to put myself in Donald Trump's shoes, understanding his motivations, his interests, his narcissism, his needs, why wouldn't you do it? Why wouldn't you do it?
I can't think of a good reason unless somehow, as the speaker, he becomes accountable to the House's ethics standards, and if that interferes with a lot of his finances. But who's going to hold him accountable if the Republicans are the majority?
He's the speaker.
Other than that one possibility that doesn't get too far, I think we're looking at Speaker Donald Trump if the Republicans take the midterm elections.
All right. You know, on that note, Joyce, I think I need a tall, stiff drink.
Preet, it's only 10:34 in the morning.
I know, but Trump is Speaker. Oh, my goodness.
So, Preet, you spend a lot of time making fun of how I say words.
No, I don't. I just have a disagreement with you on some of the words.
It's loving. But here's a question about the actual words themselves, right? We talked last week about subpoenas and whether you quash a subpoena or squash a subpoena. Clearly, you quash, not squash. But we got an email from Ruby, and she suggests that it's gone even further than quash and squash.
She wrote, I don't know if this is true. We have not independently confirmed, but we have very smart and wise listeners who we trust implicitly. And she wrote that, I've heard that some jurisdictions have attempted to eliminate the whole quash-squash problem by using quish instead of, I don't know how that solves it, but by using quish instead of quash. And then Ruby goes on to say, unfortunately, it only uncovered a new conundrum, the little-known quish-squish mistake, as in the subpoena was squished. Do you think this is a real thing?
I think we can all look forward to Sean Hannity's motion to squish.
To squish. I like to squish that guy sometimes. So we'll have more on January 6th. We'll have more on maybe on some of the Supreme Court happenings. See you next week when hopefully it's a few degrees warmer. Send us your questions to letters@cafe.com.
We'll do our best to answer them.
That's it for this week. Cafe Insider is presented by Cafe Studios and the Vox Media Podcast Network. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Joyce Vance. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The technical director is David Tatasciore. The senior producers are Adam Waller and Matthew Billy. And the Cafe team is David Curlander, Sam Oser-Staten, Noah Azulai, Nat Wiener, Jake Kaplan, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Namita Shah. Our music is by Andrew Doss. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.